Like a last breath you would breathe. You were like home to me. I don't recognize the street.
Today's Middle East Analysis podcast looks at the crisis in Syria. The track you can hear in the background is Save the Children's Song for Syria by Ellie Goulding. Find out more, download the track and donate at savethechildren.org.
Outside the cars speed by. I never heard them until now.
Hello listeners, welcome back. This is our first Middle East analysis since the summer break. Now we might have downed tools for a little over 6 weeks actually, but of course, unsurprisingly, some of the most notable events actually of the last few years have occurred during our break. And I can see someone smiling ruefully opposite me. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, our studio guest and the Bishop's consultant on the MENA region. Harry, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You're absolutely right, James. Epic developments in the last couple of months. And somehow I felt that we were cheating our listeners out of all those developments and some sort of analysis that we bring to them. So it is good to be back in studio again.
Do you know, I even felt a little bit guilty for being on holiday during these momentous events, because we're not communicating them. And so now is that time if you're up for it.
Well, those momentous events would probably continue for a while longer, so don't feel too guilty. It's a very Catholic tradition to feel guilty. Let's not.
Well, you'd never be able to have a break with what's going on in the region at the moment.
Absolutely.
There's always something. I'm going to put this on the article that accompanies this podcast, but we could go through all the things that have happened, specifically since the 21st of August, with the now confirmed chemical, so the sarin chemical weapons attacks on the outskirts of Damascus, that suburb, Ghouta, is it? Ghouta?
It's Eastern Ghouta.
Eastern Ghouta. So where do we start? We've had the international community weighing in on this. We've had talk of a UN resolution with a Chapter 7, which does permit for military action as a last resort. So disarmament of Syria's chemical arsenal. Now, Bashar al-Assad, the president, has agreed to this and also slightly tweaked the timetable to say it might be a year, might be more, might cost £1 billion. So he's said on Fox News, well, you know, my hands are up. We'll cleanse our country of these weapons. Where do we start with that, Harry? I mean, I read a very interesting article that you wrote on your website, kind of saying, well, let's not be too sidetracked by the obvious barbaric chemical weapons issue, which is graphic, it is repugnant, but there have been plenty of repugnant things that have happened.
And that is one of the points that I've been constantly hammering on, James, that yes, it is repulsive what happened, that attack with sarin chemical agents on a two or three neighborhoods was awful. And of course, it's a crime against humanity. It's against all norms of international law as we understand it. And of course, the world community should react to those attacks. And in some sense, it has already reacted. As you mentioned, the UN inspectors came back with what was described as a chilling report of what happened then. The rockets that were used or deployed in order to send those nerve agents into those inhabited population. We have had argument and counter-argument galore about who was responsible for it. But my own personal guess is that this could only have been the regime that had the ability and the know-how to do this. Besides, those rockets landed in neighborhoods that were under the control of the rebels in Syria. I somehow find it difficult to believe that they would expose themselves willingly just for the sake of propaganda or to prove to the world what a bad man the President Assad and his regime are. So in a sense, since that chilling report and since that attack on the 21st of August, a month now, things have been moving at a, what shall I say, head-spinning pace. Things have been moving on the Syria front, and things have also, interestingly enough, been moving on the Iran front. Now, on the Syria front, my answer to the specific question you intimated at, which is, Harry, do you think this is going to come together? My answer would be twofold. One, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It is very nice to say, yes, we have got an agreement. We saw John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov pretty much have a love fest in Geneva as they tried to hammer together this understanding. And we already see that there are serious questions that are coming out of this understanding in terms of interpretation. Each side interprets it in the way they feel they should interpret it. So let's wait and see where it actually goes. I think that the Assad regime, faced with an inevitable military attack by the Americans and the French, an attack that President Obama incidentally did not want to do. He probably prayed, if he ever does pray, he prayed more during those few weeks than he ever did during his presidency, saying, Lord, please spare me this cup, and not wanting to attack. And lo and behold, like a deus ex machina, like a salvation, the Russian proposal came of, you know what, let's disarm Syria of its chemical weapons, and then things should be okay, and you don't need to actually attack Syria. Yes, well, we'll see whether the President Assad will or will not be upfront about his chemical weapons. He might give a list which pretty much would be the list that the Americans and the Russians have of what he has in his country. However, from there on, to lead the inspectors to the places where the depots where those chemical weapons are, to actually taking them out of the country or destroying them, this is where he's going to be at his cleverest and at his foxiest, in my opinion. And interestingly enough, when people tell me, oh, you know, give the man a break, I do give the man a break. I give the man a break all the time. It's not personal. Sometimes it tends to get personal given the level of atrocities, James. But it's not personal. It's just when I see the number of people in Syria who are suffering, that is what really gets to me. And if you just go across the border from Syria into Lebanon, and Lebanon has had experience with Syrian occupation since Bashir Ismail's assassination years and years ago, followed by a tutelage by Syria, the presence of the army. If you talk to some Lebanese people, they who have experienced the vagaries and the oppression of the Syrian regime upon them, they would tell you stories that we in the naive West have absolutely no clue about. We take a man on his word. That doesn't work in the Middle East too well, I'm afraid. So in a sense, will it work? The proof of the pudding is in the eating. But you're also right, James, when I intimated in that article you're kindly posting on the webpage, for me, the issue is not those chemical weapons. And I'll tell you why. 1,400 people dead, many of whom were children, is an awful incident. But compared to the 117,000 who have died over the past 2.5 years, I think it's extremely treacherous and wrong of us to divert our attention and the attention of the whole world to the fact that we're doing something about those chemical weapons while not really addressing the issue of the conventional weapons, rockets, planes, tanks, that are wreaking havoc in the country and that have provided not only 117,000 deaths, but 2 million refugees outside the country, 4 million refugees in the country. Schools are not working. People don't have food. Hospitals are not working. Doctors have fled the country. This country is crying out for help. And therefore, on a humanitarian basis, I feel very sorry. And I say, yes, it is sad what happened with the chemical weapons, and retributive action of some form or another should happen. And we are dealing with that. But we should also look at the larger picture. And the larger picture is the 2.5 year civil war.
Now, it's a good time, actually, talking about some of those statistics, those heart-wrenching statistics, facts of what's happened, really, over the last few years. The Save the Children song that they've taken from Ellie Goulding. Do you know who Ellie Goulding is?
No, I don't know who Ellie Goulding is until you said to me, oh, this is Ellie Goulding, and then I thought, well,
rather popular these days with those there youngsters.
Oh, well, there you are. There you are. I'm over 25, James, so...
Well, only just. No, she is rather good, and this song is rather moving, I have to say. I Know You Care.
Song, and we shared it together, I Know You Care, and it's a beautiful song, and it's adopted by Save the Children, and Save the Children, like UNICEF and others, are doing a wonderful job under impossible circumstances to try and help those children that have died as a result. And those children are the new generations. The older generations are dying, but so are the newer ones. So who's going to be there to see Syria through this crisis, through this plight? If I'm exaggerating a bit, if I'm dramatizing a bit, I'm doing it for a purpose. The purpose being that this is not an academic issue. This is an existential issue at the very heart of the Middle East and North Africa. And as Christian Amanpour from CNN said, it is not only a geostrategic or a geopolitical issue, it's a human issue. And that is why when I see what I see, it actually bothers me. And the silence of some people or the mendacity of others also annoys me as well.
Well, for those of you that would want to support that particular cause, Save the Children UK, just hit Google, put Save the Children UK in and YouTube, and you will come up with that Ellie Goulding track, and download it from iTunes, and I believe there's a donation made to that particular
cause.
And
we're running that, aren't we?
Yeah, well, you heard it at the very start of this podcast, and I'm sure you'll hear it at the end as well. Harry, I'd like to move on to certain Christian realities, because I'm not saying that with this podcast we don't talk about them, because we certainly do and certainly should. But in the particular Syria crisis, we haven't said a huge amount, but yet that's changed somewhat with Maalula. So tell us a little bit about that village, which I believe is a Christian village where they still speak a form of Aramaic,
yes,
the language
they
of
do
Christ.
Speak a version of Aramaic, and it is known as a Christian village. It's actually a village with Christians and Muslims living in it. And actually, the Muslims speak the same dialect as the Christians do. Maalula is about, 40 miles northeast of Damascus, in the northern suburbs of Damascus, in what is known as Reef Dimashq. It is in the Qalamun Mountains, and it is a wonderful place. It's very quaint. It's very attractive as a tourist resort, and it's a place where you have so many monasteries. The one that immediately comes to mind is the monastery of Mar Taqla, Deir Mar Taqla. Then a little bit further down from that is Sayyid Naya. There are many hermits' caves there. There are many monasteries there. There are many shrines there. In fact, I've heard people calling it the Lourdes of the Middle East. It is a very nice place. It's a village, and it's an agglomeration of three villages, actually, and this is one of them. And it has become quite attractive and quite prominent because of the Christian population in it, because of the Aramaic influence for it, and because recently people like Jeremy Bowen from the BBC and others have been to Maalula covering the war, the fighting that took place between some jihadi movements on the one hand and the Syrian army on the other. So you had lots of Christians and Muslims fleeing the village, more out of fear than out of destruction, dare I add. And therefore, a lot of drama was concocted on top of this, with people sort of saying, my God, is this the end of Christianity as we know it? So yes, it has been in our headlines. And every time I look at the headlines, somehow they manage to put Maalula in there as the Christian dimension of this war. But excuse me, Christians are all over Syria. There is a huge Christian community in Aleppo. And as I've told you time and again, James, and I will never shy away from telling it yet one more time, I'm Armenian, and there is a huge Armenian community in Aleppo, and they're suffering as much as anybody else. So let us not dramatize for the sake of drama.
Now, one thing that bothers me slightly about the whole Christian question and the Christian communities, and I'm not saying this is media spin, I'm actually going to ask you whether it is, but you see the portrayal, and of course it seems to be something that in the West is quite a good picture to portray. You know, Christians trying to go about their daily lives, trying to cope with this awful conflict in the middle of all that. You suddenly see that they're affected with Maalula, of course. And then you hear reports that, you know, they're sort of Christians are pro-Assad and more on that side of things, which of course makes us think, oh, is that a good thing? Is that good for peace and prosperity? And so I find myself very confused as to whether the whole Christians equals regime equation actually works, or whether if you read sort of little case studies like nuns in Molulu that actually stayed behind and are saying, well, you know, nobody was really troubling us. We weren't directly threatened. I don't know. Were churches desecrated? Are the Christians pro al-Assad? I mean, I find myself very confused about the Christians in Syria.
James, the whole Syria crisis is a confusing crisis. And for 2.5 years, it has become increasingly more confused. I go back to the first 6 months of those demonstrations 2.5 years ago. Weren't they peaceful? You and I were sitting here even then talking about these people going out. They weren't even asking for the removal of the president or the change of the regime. All they wanted was some freedom, some dignity, and some economic sustenance. And look what happened two years later. The reaction of the authorities to those peaceful demonstrations was so brutal that we have weaponized the whole uprising. We in the West sat on our hands and didn't do much for the pretty much for the first 2 years of the crisis, and that didn't help much in the way this crisis was aggravated. And now we have a situation which I agree with you entirely. It is very confusing. There are almost three wars happening in Syria at the moment, James. There is the war between the Syrian army and the regime and the opposition or the rebels. That's one war, and it's been going on for well nigh 2 years now. Then there is a war between the Free Syrian Army, which is the so-called, what we call, and I'm going to use very tacky, cheesy labels here just to make the point without confusing everybody about what I'm on about. The so-called moderate Syrian army, which are against Assad, but who are inclusive and who want to create a democratic Syria, which actually is equal for all Christians, Muslims, Kurds, Druze, Alawites, Shiis, Sunnis, everybody would be a human being in the real sense of the word. These people are fighting the regime on the one hand, but they're also now in some places, Azaz is one example near the Turkish border, where they are also fighting an increasing number of jihadis or takfiris or radicalized Muslims, a lot of them incidentally coming from abroad. They're not homebred, these people. Syrians, by and large, are a very accommodating people. These are people who've come from abroad and who are fighting this and who have this vicious, pernicious, exclusive mentality of wanting to impose their own version of Islam, which excludes everything and everybody else, and which ultimately boils down to the creation of a caliphate which basically runs the country. So in a sense, you've got the war between the opposition and the rebels, then you've got the war between the moderate rebels and those radicalized rebels, and sometimes there are unholy alliances between one and the other. We've seen this in Maalula. What happened in Maalula? In Maalula, basically, the Syrian army and the National Defense Force, which is a militia that was set up to help the army in Syria recently because the army was unable to cope with what was happening, were at the southern entrance of Maalula, this village, which we're calling a Christian Aramaic village. Then the rebels were holding the entrances to the north of the village. What happened on the 5th of September is that the Nusra Front, which is an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group, came in, and their intention was not actually to attack or destroy Christians. Their intention was to get rid of the Syrian army. But because of the confusion there, and because the authorities in Syria want very much to use this confessional dimension as a way of telling the West, you see, if it's not us, can you imagine what will be if these people come and take over? That it is almost like they're giving them free course to do what they do best, which is loathsome, and then turn around and say, well, only we can control those excesses. So in a sense, there is a multiplication of those movements fighting. You've got the worst of the worst in my books is the ISIS, which is something to do with the Al-Qaeda affiliated movements from Damascus and from Iraq. They're known in Arabic as Al-Dawla. Then you have got the Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front. Then you've got all sorts of multiplications. You've got Ahrar al-Sham, you've got Ahrar Ahfad al-Rasul. You've got all sorts of people who are fighting this war. And this is why when we in the West, even the most well-intentioned of us, say we want to help the moderates, we actually don't know where to find them sometimes, given the realities of what's happening. Look at the north of Syria, in places like Raqqa, where it is believed that Father Paolo Dall'Olio, the Jesuit priest who was kidnapped, that he's either imprisoned there or held there or even dead there. Ditto with the two Syrian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox bishops. But that area has become pretty much a no-go area, a zone that people don't want to move into. In a sense, James, northern Syria, I have heard some analysts compare it to Waziristan or to southern Yemen in terms of an Al-Qaeda area that nobody dares go into. This is what is happening to Syria, and this is what really bothers me, because this is a wonderful country that shouldn't be where it is now, and it is a country where we Christians should actually be faithful to our teachings, to our principles, and not use the political drama of the moment for our own purposes either.
Now, I don't really, or I certainly didn't want to focus this podcast on intervention, military intervention. And I certainly didn't want to get into a, well, what do you think, ... But actually, I'm afraid I do want to know. You know, the Pope says violence begets violence, and I can't disagree with that. Mm. There was a day of prayer, of course, a world day of prayer for peace, the world over, but fundamentally focusing on the issues of the Middle East and Syria. It's hard to know. I mean, I hand on heart, I don't really know where I stand. I want to see an end to the bloodshed. I know that's where I stand. But what is the case for military intervention? And more to the point, what is the case or benefit of non-intervention?
Well, this is a question that would have me draw two breaths, not one, James, for me to be able to answer this. There are so many different answers to that. If there were to be a military intervention, let me start by using my lawyer's hat. If there were going to be any military intervention, the easiest way, the surest and most direct way would be to say that we go to the United Nations Security Council, where we have five permanent members, and we get a resolution, we adopt a resolution there authorizing the use of force. Then we go and use that force in order to help whatever it is that the resolution would demand of us, whether it is regime change or whether it is opening the airspace, providing humanitarian corridors, whatever. Now, that is not going to happen and hasn't happened for the last 2.5 years because Russia, also aided and abetted by China, have refused and have vetoed any resolution that goes that way. The French, the British, and even the Americans, despite their very wishy-washy attitude on Syria, have actually struggled to get something out of the United Nations Security Council. That then takes us to something which is part of jus cogens in international law, part of international positive law, of customary international law, called responsibility to protect, R2P. What does R2P do? R2P is supposed to say that it is the responsibility of the ruler of a country to take care and protect his or her citizens. And if they cannot, it is the responsibility of the international community to come and help those citizens who are being abused or who are not being protected in that country. However, that also has a whole host of rules and conditions to it, and it is very dangerous to do because Syria is not Libya. Syria is not a country along the periphery of the MENA region. It is at the very heart of the MENA region. And if you start any kind of military attack on Syria, then you are actually opening yourself up to a whole host of unintended consequences. And do we really want to go there? Do we have the gumption? Do we have the staying power? Do we have the stomach? Do we have the financial resources? Do we have the ability to maintain that? Remember how many days we had to bomb Kosovo before we actually achieved the purpose and got Slobodan Milosevic out. In a sense, it's a very, very dangerous situation. But there is a trend of thought saying that we cannot just sit idly by and let those 117,000 dead, those refugees, those children, those the infrastructure of the country go to ruins just because we don't want to do anything. And this is why my hope at the moment is that, and it's the hope of everybody. You see, let me digress here for a minute. When I speak like that, whether as a lawyer or as a political analyst or as a church consultant, whichever hat I do wear, people immediately look, oh, you're a warmonger. No, I'm not a warmonger, but at the same time, I don't really respect much who people who sit there and say, oh, no, we shouldn't do anything. War is wrong. We shouldn't resort to violence. And I sit there and saying, okay, I'm nodding my head and saying yes, and I'm waiting for the continuation of that sentence, that war is wrong, violence should not be used. I think you and I would agree on that. However, what is the alternative? Then people said we should try and get a political solution. Yes, I'm the first for that. I will be running the marathon if we can get the political solution. But how can you get a political solution? How can you get dialogue when you've got a regime that is not vulnerable to those ideas of openness and dialogue, who actually has it in its head that it is going to win this war and will use any kind of ruse or trick to achieve its aim? And we have countries who are supporting it. So when the World Council of Churches only this week comes up with all sorts of statements and resolutions, and they did only 2 days ago, James, saying, you know, dialogue and political dialogue is the only way. Yes, political dialogue is the only way. Yes, sir. Yes, madam. But my question is, what about all the destruction and all the deaths? What about the 60% of the country that wants change? How do we get that dialogue incarnated when there is a regime supported by its allies who is refusing to go there? That is my question. So I'm not somebody who's chomping at the bit saying, yes, let's send the Tomahawk cruisers in or let's send our F-16s in there. I have, believe you me, I have lived through wars. I've seen wars. I know what war means. And I don't want that upon anybody. But by the same token, I don't accept wimpish attitudes which say no war, no violence, political dialogue. Let's sit and maybe God will send us the solution when he is free.
You know, if we don't actually do anything, or if we keep waiting for political solutions that are just designed not to work, basically, or there are too many barriers in the way, won't we still be looking at those awful YouTube videos and awful, you know, forget which side it's coming from at this point, you know, these barbarous videos that we're seeing of the most horrific things?
It's absolutely true. You know, one of the, you know, you always make fun. Well, you don't really make fun. I make fun of myself as far as Twitter goes. But I have a few people following me. I've got a very snobbish attitude to Twitter. I'm not there to communicate. I'm there just to enjoy what some people are saying and writing. One of the people I follow a lot is a woman from the Middle East, North Africa. Her name is Mina Loraibi, and she's from Al Sharq Al Awsat newspaper, probably one of the most far-reaching newspapers across the Middle East. And she wrote something 2 days ago, a tweet which I actually retweeted. You might have spotted it because I know you sneak in to see what's Harry thinking today. And she said something. She said, Yes, 1,400 deaths, chemical weapons, I agree. What about the planes, the bombs, the tanks, and the deaths that have nothing to do with the chemical weapons? You know, that is the fundamental question. When we talk about Maalula, I've heard some Christians, hierarchs for that matter, describe Maalula as the wound of Christ. I mean, can we be a little bit more dramatic than that? The situation is so bad that we need to find a way. Look, why did Syria and Russia even come close to saying, we will give you a list of our chemical weapons, we will join the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1993? They did it because they thought that finally Obama had no choice but to attack, even though John Kerry, his Secretary of State, described the attack as being unbelievably small. Now, I love it. We are announcing to the enemy, if Syria were to be the enemy, since we are supposed to attack it, it's going to be a very unbelievably small pinprick. Don't worry, you can sit in your houses. We'll go in there and we'll come out. It's very, very bad. And there have been so many Christian church leaders who have spoken out, who have said that the Christians are not with the regimes. The Christians are with hope, with dignity, with freedom. We do not have to conform. Jesus did not conform. Jesus did not go by the laws of the day. If Jesus didn't have the rebel in him, we wouldn't be all sitting here and calling ourselves Christians. That is the prophetic courage that I'm talking about. But I look at it, and to continue the imagery of the Christian faith, James, I would say, you know what? In a lot of cases, it's unfortunate, but after 2.5 years, it's obvious to me that fear has crucified hope.
I was going to actually come up with another question, but that's a wonderful conclusion. So I think we'll leave it there. Now, for those of you who have just heard about Dr. Harry Hagopian and his musings, they are on Twitter. They really are. At Harry Hagopian. Please do check that out. There's loads of insightful stuff there. You will realise it's a particularly, I wouldn't say counter-Twitter way of communicating, but Harry is not bending to anyone's will on that. It's his own way of doing things. Check it out. You'll see cartoons, insights, some really good stuff, and some retweets for people that Harry follows or takes a look at as well. For the church's account, that's Catholic EW. And the home of Middle East analysis is catholicnews.org.uk. And we're very grateful for you joining us for our half-hour podcast today. I think we'll leave you with Ellie Goulding again, that wonderful track, I Know You Care, which is being used by Save the Children UK to raise some money, obviously, with that terrible plight in Syria.
And you publicly let everybody know that I'm an ignoramus who doesn't know who Ellie Goulding is, James.
Well, you'll have to live with it. Here she is.
I know it's always been there.